Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Let's talk.
Ring of Fire is a new global history of the outbreak of the First World War. As war broke out in 1914, not a nation on earth understood the magnitude of what they were about to face. To win it, whole populations had to be mobilized, and neutrality was impossible to practice. We all know about the grand sweep of history, the great men involved, but there are quite a few interesting facts about this. And it takes, if you will, a look at the ordinary person, the more unusual person during the First World War. It is a book written by Alexander Churchill and Nikolai Eberhurst. And I'm delighted to say that Nikolai joins me live on the line now. Nikolai, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Whereabouts are you, by the way, today? Where are you based?
I'm based in Denmark, just north of Copenhagen.
Very nice part of the world indeed. Now, this book, it takes a different look. Just explain what your background is. Professor in history, what is your background that makes you qualified to write Ring of Fire?
I'm an educated historian with a master's degree in history from the University of Copenhagen. And been working on the First World War forever, mainly focusing on the Eastern Front and Austria-Hungary. Also working, my day-to-day job as it is working in an archive as a head archivist.
Oh, brilliant. That is sort of almost like my dream job. Now, we know the First World War, it's very interesting, Austrian and Hungarian Empire, because you can argue that at least four empires go in, and the three royal families go in to the First World War, and only one comes out, which is the British royal family, because the German and the Russian royal family are booted in historical touch. But you're based in Denmark, you live in Denmark, and we don't really think about the Danes in the First World War, much to our chagrin. We don't think about the sort of Africa either in the First World War. We certainly don't think about, Australian specific. So what is the aim? What are you trying to sort of focus on in Ring of Fire?
Well, what we really wanted to do was write a very globally oriented history of the First World War. We know these classic works like The Guns of August, which roughly concentrates on the same time period, but it is also very much concentrated only on what happens on the Western Front, or what will become the Western Front in France and Belgium. What we wanted to do is really say that this is not a local conflict, and we say this is a world war. The world is involved, and even if you bring up Denmark, what did Denmark do? I mean, we're a neutral country, of course, so why is it interesting to look at a neutral power? Well, because neutrality is sort of a relative term. You can't really be neutral. Say at the outbreak, you don't know if you're going to be involved at a later point. You don't know if you'll be able to maintain neutrality. Your trade is disrupted. You have to mobilize your army still to protect your borders and your neutrality. And of course, as you also say, what happens in South America? How is trade impacted in South America? What happens in Spain, for that matter? What happens in Africa? What happens in Far East Asia? All these things work together, and that's what we really wanted to bring into the book and into the outbreak of the war.
Because, like it or lump it, as the saying goes, this is a time when there are still empires going. Britain's got an empire, Germany's got an empire, or trying to get an empire, obviously, in Africa. The French have definitely got an empire. The Spanish have got an empire. Spanish Morocco's still going. So there are...
Austria-Hungary.
Austria-Hungary, exactly. And I'll come on to that in a minute, because that's a fact. This is by its very nature, but we are sucked into the horrors of trench warfare, of the slog. where there is obviously what's happening with Gallipoli is an obvious point of view. But then again, we've got what's happening in German West Africa, German East Africa, those conflicts as well that's going on. And you've got what's happening, you know, in the Alps. You've got the vicious fighting, the horrendous fighting that's happening between Austro-Hungarians. So it really is not just that slog, you know, going through Flanders, etc.
No, that's the war people know, and the one we normally concentrate on, because a lot of the literature is very marked by an Anglophone audience and an Anglophone historiography, writing about it, talking about it. But what we also wanted to do was sort of say, well, let's give a more balanced view. So let's say we want equal measures of what happens in the West and equal measures what happens in, say, East Prussia, say Galicia, in what is today like Poland and Ukraine, what happens in the Balkans, and really give these people whose voices we don't really hear a lot, give them, you know, a voice again, and let them say it, because it is also a book that is very much based on first-hand accounts and primary sources like that.
And you just said Prussia, of course. You've got the whole thing with Konigsberg, that whole Eastern Front, which tends to get overlooked as well, because the revolution comes, you know, at some point. You know, the Russian army is demoralized, etc. I mean, just off the top of my head, I'm just thinking, I mean, I really don't know that much about what happens on the Eastern campaign. Is it static? You know, is it cavalry? You know, what's happening with politics? I mean, it is a whole, you know, a whole, if you like, a collective blank, because obviously we get carried away with the revolution, and then of course the killing of the royal family. So we don't really think about what led up to it.
No, I mean, we hear a little bit about Tannenberg in the beginning of the war, a big impressive German victory. But what happened before that? What happened, as I say, in Galicia, where Austria-Hungary and Russia are fighting, where the Russians have much more success? We don't hear about that much. And it's partly because, of course, we have focused our view on the Tommies in the trenches in Flanders and, you know, Puppies and the Somme and Passchendaele and these names that we know and have sort of ingrained into our collective memory. But in the East, well, you had the revolution and you had, you know, a civil war coming after that was much more bloody for the Russians. And then you had the Soviet Union that didn't really care too much about what happened in the before time, so to say. And on the other side, you have Austria-Hungary, which after the war is, of course, split up into a million small nations and people, and they want to make their own story. They also don't really want to focus too much on the war. So it sort of gets forgotten. But the stories are there. And if you look, and what we've done is really look for them and try to include them. I mean, it's these massive battles that we don't hear much about.
And Austro-Hungary is really interesting because that's a massive empire. I mean, that's just, and we seem to have airbrushed that one out as well from our collective history. But they go in, and the other thing is the way that these nations go into the war. They're still seeing. I mean, you know, France goes into the war. I mean, the closest conflict they've sort of had of this type in Europe has been, you know, the Franco-Prussian War, 1870, and you could argue maybe a bit of the Crimean War, but this is the first mechanized war in the terms of the way that the war. So you may go in with your brightly colored uniforms and that whole great game, which has been, you know, which has been happening in the Victorian era, you know, around the Dardanelles and gunboats going up the Dardanelles, etc. But this is when it turns into you know, mechanized war and killing on a horrendous and to a slaughter, if you like, on the Western Front. And then also, you've got these old empires going off to fight, thinking, well, war has always been fought that way, i.e. Turks, Austro-Hungarians, Russians. And then they pretty quickly discover that this new warfare, it isn't the same, and that is end of their empires, basically.
Yes, I mean, the time frame of this book is very much focused on the very first weeks of the war, the outbreak. The thought was a longer, but as we went along, we you know, character restraints and word restraints and all that. We were like, okay, if we just concentrate on the first few weeks, we can actually do this properly and do it in a detailed way. And where we made the cut is roughly around the 11th of September, which might seem like a sort of a weird cutoff date, but that is when the Battle of the Marne ends and the Germans retreat. It is also where the Austro-Hungarians retreat in Galicia. So what we focused on was basically, as you say, these first offensives. What happens when every big nation, every big power launches their pre-war war plans? And then what is going on? What happens? And then we end when all of them, well, maybe perhaps Serbia is the only one that actually manages to succeed somewhat in as much as they survive the invasion by Austria-Hungary. But we ended when all of that pre-war planning is done. And now you have to sort of look at it and say, okay, then what now?
Is it because you're looking at ordinary people as well, aren't you? You're not talking about just generals. It must be really interesting to look at the way that they're looking at war. Because now we would look at war, if we have to go to war, we look at it a different way. You know, people are saying, should we get involved with this? Should we be supporting Ukraine, etc.? We're very much soul searching. And this is a different time. And so I suppose when you're reading this, Nikolai, when you're researching this, Nikolai, you know, it is that it's seen by many as a great adventure or a test of manhood. And people don't want to, quote unquote, miss out.
We were really focused on saying, okay, we've heard the story of politicians and generals and big strategy and all that. Let's say, okay, we've done that. Let's look at the people who are affected by this and their reaction to it and how they respond to war, both as civilians, as old people, as women, as men, as children, and as soldiers. And as you say, there's a wide variety of ways that people react to this. This massive war. In the beginning, you have a sort of sense of relief or release in a way because you've been going around in a very tense situation in the build-up to the war. And then all of a sudden the war comes and now we know we're at war. So many people experience this and it sort of transforms into what's sometimes called this spirit of August in Germany, which is sort of this, you know, rapturous crowds gathering in the street and singing and marching off to war. But then behind the scene, you find the family men who don't really want to go because they have families at home. Who's going to who's going to provide for these people? All this is also a part of the story. So it's not just one-sided whatsoever.
And if you are, where are you getting these sources from? Because obviously Europe, it must be quite easy to find. But if you're looking at the whole picture, getting from somebody from North Africa, getting somebody from West or East Africa, for example, where are you finding, is it newspaper reports or, I know you're an archivist, Nikolai, so, you know, you've got the things here. So where do you find it from?
No, we did find this, a lot of it from newspapers because, of course, period newspapers would often publicize letters. Of course, you have to be aware of that there's also a propaganda element in what is published and what is not. But we, of course, also went and really looked at sources in a variety of different languages. And we wanted it to be not just, okay, what is translated into English? Let's go and find the Russian sources. Let's go and find the Polish, the Serbians, as you say, the African sources as well, and try to find some of them. Of course, been written in their sort of, let's call them colonial languages, French or English. But really, we really wanted to focus on and say, let's try and bring sources that we haven't really seen being translated into English and bring them to an English-speaking audience.
I'm just really interested as well as those who are, should we say they are subjects of an empire? So, you know, you can, you know, your African troops, your Indian troops, or even to a certain extent, your Australian, your New Zealand, your South African troops, because this is a war being felt for, you know, they're under no immediate threat from this. In the Pacific, the last big conflict surely has been what the Russian Sino War of 1906 or whatever, yeah? So therefore, they're under no sort of big threat, as it were. I mean, what goes through the mentality? I mean, the first Australian casualties are you found out, they're not in Gallipoli, they're in the Pacific.
and Pacific. I mean, Australia also have ambitions in their immediate surrounding area or sphere of interest, if you will. New Zealand too. They really go after these small German outposts in the Pacific, Samoa and Papua, and that is, as you say, where they have the first casualties. We don't really think much about this, but they're really out there already in the first days of August and want to be a player, because there's a lot of feeling of, let's not miss out, let's be invited at the table when this is all over. If you're not part of it in any way, well, you're not invited and you don't have a say. So that's a big part of it.
So we're seeing Australians take on German forces in around Papua New Guinea and Samoa. Is that what we're
Yes, exactly.
Wow, yeah. I had no idea. Sorry, go on. So that must be a complete mind blower to think about. But that's empire, isn't it?
Exactly, and you also have it more near. If you look at something like Germany, being a Dane, we also included quite a lot of sources from Danish soldiers in the German army, because you had the war in southern Jutland in 1864, where a big chunk of that became part of Germany, yeah. And that's only about 50 years before the war. But they're regarded now as being German subjects. So all the men there who are ethnic Danes, speak Danish, live in a Danish. Almost majority in those areas, they're recruited just like any other German men, and they don't want to go because they don't think they should fight for Germany, which they still consider an enemy. But at the same time, what if Germany wins and we were not with them? Are they then going to restrain our minorities' rights, and it's just going to get worse? So it's a very tricky situation.
And the Danes are laying mines, because I'd never thought about this, because when someone like Spain goes neutral or something like that, it's quite easy because it's the Iberian Peninsula. So you've got the Pyrenees, which is a natural block. However, if you're Denmark and you go neutral, you can't just say I'm neutral and because, oh, okay, that's not a problem. Yeah, no problem there. We won't touch you. So you have to take, like I said, you have to mobilize your army just in case that, you know, somebody doesn't obey the quote unquote rules of war.
Yes, exactly. It's very much a question of playing this game when you're caught between these big powers. And I think I said in the beginning as well, when you read the response to the outbreak of the war, it's not very different in, say, Copenhagen than it is in Berlin or Paris, because nobody really knows, are they going to be involved? Belgium wants to stay neutral, but they're in the path of Germany and they don't have much of a choice. Denmark is in the same risk, if you will, the Netherlands too. And yes, you have to play this game. So what Denmark basically does is say, okay, we're going to mine the straits because then we can protect Germany. But at the same time, we're also going to put like a trade block between that you can't export food to Germany. It's going both ways, and then we're going to mobilize our army and dig trenches and man the defenses and be ready if something happens. Not that the Danish army was anything to write home about and wouldn't stand up to much, but it's still about protecting yourself.
I'm really interesting. I mean, so because you and of course you've got Alexandra with you as well on this one. I mean, with a subject this huge, it must be really difficult to cut it down so that you can actually, otherwise it would be, you know, all over the place. So how do you put this together? Do you take ten examples, or do you follow some of the people's stories through? Because it must be very difficult to present this as well, because we know what happens next, because you're an archivist, you know, we're historians. So how do you write it and compile it in a way that doesn't seem to be as if the people know what is going to happen at that point? Because in 1914, we have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, so we wrote it together, and it sort of was a perfect partnership, because we didn't have we don't have much of an interest that overlaps when it comes to the First World War. So she focuses a lot on the Western Front and speaks French. I don't speak French, and I focus on the Eastern Front a lot. So we could very nicely divide it. And what we very quickly realized was that all these people are actually talking about the same things. And wouldn't it be interesting to put a Slovene from Austria-Hungary next to a person in Brussels and say, okay, if you didn't know where they were from, if you didn't have the national monikers to sort of say where are these people from in the world, well, they would probably be almost indistinguishable from each other. So a lot of it was also driven by, okay, we keep finding these reports. Even the title of the book, Ring of Fire, is a phrase that we found in three different people from widely different parts of the world using the exact same phrase, saying Europe is now a ring of fire. We have a Russian poet writing it. We have a guy in France saying the same thing almost the exact same days, and where there's no sort of overlap where they could have heard it from each other. So it's also to bring in that we aren't that different as people, and our experience of this thing is sort of universal. So a lot of that drove what we picked out to talk about is to say, okay, what are these overall feelings that we can sort of trace in every place and then put them next to each other.
I find this other point fascinating, because this will be, Nicola, do you know what a pub quiz is? You know, you're aware of a pub quiz. So this is going to be the pub quiz question about where were the first British shots fired in the First World War. And everybody will probably say, oh, it's probably somewhere in France. But absolutely not. And when people say, well, you see, the problem is that we talk too much about diversity, and it's too much about, you know, the world war's gone woke. So explain where and who fires the first shot for the British in the war.
It's African colonial soldiers in West Africa. And I think that's fascinating. The very first days of the war, they make an incursion into German territory and fire shots. And that is weeks before the BEF or the British Expeditionary Forces are even arrived in France. And I think from, as you say, a British perspective, you've Britain's role in the war is very central to the narrative of the First World War. And when it comes to this period where we're talking now, you have the Battle of Mons, which is the first British engagement in Belgium, or on the Western Front, or what would become the Western Front. And you have all these myths about the angels of Mons and all this fairy tales going around it. And we're saying, okay, but this is just a minor part of a massive war. So if you're going into this thinking, oh, I'm going to learn a lot about the British victory at Mons or whatever, which is pretty much more of a defeat, well, you're not going to get it, because it's just such a small part, and it's just part of a bigger battle involving 20 times as many French people and 20 times as many German people. So it's also about really bringing into perspective what the size of these battles are and where people fit into them.
Is it one of the situations where you get a better understanding, it's much more fascinating when you find something about like Papua New Guinea happening, or what's happening in the Near East, for example, you know, Iraq, Iran, Mesopotamia, or, you know, French Morocco, Spanish Morocco, whatever we're going to call it. And when you said the first shot, did you say it was the East or the West that the first shot? Because I'm thinking Namibia.
It's the West.
So it's
West. It's around Ghana and Nigeria, area, Togoland.
Right, okay.
Germany have some colonies up there. So that's where the first shots are fired. But yeah, this about finding things. A lot of it was also, we really wanted to bring the both sides of these battles, because, for example, take Mons again. You have a very Anglo-centric view of this battle. We really wanted to also bring in some of the German voices that are on the other side. Now, it turned out that these Germans were actually, a lot of them were Danes conscripted into the German army. So you had a lot of sources suddenly, and it should be translated from Danish. But really, what we really wanted was this, that we have a source from, say, a Frenchman, and then who says, okay, we're attacking this hill. And then we would also have a German source that says we're going over that same hill, and have these two voices from two people who very likely looked at each other.
Yeah.
Across the battlefield, to get this both sides of the battle, and say in the East we have, you know, Austro-Hungarian soldiers charging a woods, and then we hear from the Russians that are defending the wood. And so a lot of the work also went into trying to track down, okay, which exact company is this, and then trying to find, okay, can we find a person from this company who survived the war and was there and experienced and wrote something down, and then tried to bring it in. So we really did our work in trying to make it a back and forward even when we go around.
Now, you see, the romantic in me has visions of you, Nikolai, in a huge library, you know, with cross-referencing cards and, you know, on a ladder with wheels on it, doing that across. I'm sorry, listeners, I'm going back and forth on my chair to check and go, hang on, I've got the third Prussian Hussars here, or something like that. So, but how on earth do you, because what you just said is difficult enough anyway. So how on earth did you put that together then?
Well, I'm sorry to sort of bring it down to the romantics because I would love to say it's true and that's what we did all the time. But I will say that a lot of this kind of work would not have been possible before, but with modern technology, it is, because you've suddenly opened up the entire world through the internet. More and more sources, letters, diaries, accounts are being published, are being digitized, or you can easily figure out where they are, searching in archival databases around the world and get a hold of them. A lot of this was also just not, you know, was published in, say, Polish or Czech or Slovenian languages, but would never make it. And it's a relatively easy to get book in one country, but it's completely unknown to us because it's never been translated, it's never been worked with. So there, it was also about trying to figure out, okay, we're just gonna spend a lot of money buying a lot of books and hope we find something good, but also simply going in and saying, okay, we need to really track down, is there any place we can find a book from somebody or a letter or something in an archive where they might have digitized an account from this person that was there on that day?
As a Danish historian, what's it like reading those first-person reports of Danes who are, through an accident of geography, suddenly find themselves serving in the Kaiser's army? I mean, they must ring true to you as a Dane, surely.
Well, definitely. I mean, I think you can't neglect or how it feels to really read something. I think if you're British and you go to the Western Front and stand on the Somme, you probably feel something that another person from another country might not feel, because it's sort of, you can easily imagine that, okay, I am from this country, I share a history, I share some values. And then when you read it, you realize that the language is something you know, or you can put yourself in these people's shoes in a different way. I mean, when I started out studying Austria-Hungary, and I always said, well, it was really nice studying a country like that, where everybody is sort of still fighting with each other, or there is a lot of conflict, and then being a Dane from the outside and say, I have no bone in this fight, I'm completely outsider, you can't blame me for being supportive of Hungarian causes contra Slovak causes or Romanian causes or something. But now, of course, when it then gets in and it's your own country, well, it does make a difference. And we also went on a trip to the battlefields and seeing Danish graves with Danish names, and having read about what happened to these people, it makes for something different that I don't think a lot of Danes normally feel, because it's very distant for us.
I have to ask you this because I've got two very good friends who are from Greenland. They're half Inuit, half Danish. Is there any, does Greenland get a look in? Because I mean, it's a hot topic at the moment.
It is a hot topic at the moment. Not because we want it to be, but it is. It has finally entered the center of the world stage. But we don't have much on Greenland, unfortunately.
I'm visions of people, visions of people in kayaks coming over the hill, sort of thing, you know.
we had to limit ourselves in some regards.
The book is called Ring of Fire. I could talk to you about this until probably about Tuesday, but I'm going to run out of time. The book is called Ring of Fire, A New Global History. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Go to the bookstore, click on the front cover, and it orders the book for you. It's by Alexander Churchill and Nikolai Eberhost. Nikolai, it's been... are you on the social media? Can people find you online?
So they can find me both on Twitter or X on at PikeGray1418, and also on the same handle on Blue Sky. And I also have a Substack that is just at Nikolai Iberholst. For my co-author, it is at Alex Churchill on Blue Sky, and she has a Alex Churchill's History on Substack.
The book is called Ring of Fire. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.